From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll speak with Nian Chang. Her memoir, Life and Death in Shanghai, recounts her 6.5-year imprisonment during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. Also today, I'll talk with musician Carl Finch, the founder of the group Brave Combo. They specialize in playing familiar songs in new styles, like their polka arrangement of Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze. A rock historian, Ed Ward, resurrects The Remains, a little-known 60s folk rock group, and book critic John Leonard reviews two new biographies of philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Nian Chang. Her memoir, Life and Death in Shanghai, is an account of her 6.5-year imprisonment during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. She was accused of everything from speaking English in public and wearing bourgeois clothes to spying. Nian Chang was born into a wealthy landowning family. She met her husband in 1939 at the London School of Economics. They returned to China, where he became director of the foreign ministry in the Kuomintang regime. In spite of Mao's revolution, Chang and her husband stayed, continuing to live a prosperous life in their home, which had many antiques and works of art. Her husband later became the general manager of Shell Oil in China. When he died, Nian Chang was hired as a consultant. When Red Guards first came to her home, they asked Chang to atone for her capitalist misdeeds. When she refused, she was imprisoned. Her possessions were either confiscated or destroyed. While in prison, she suffered from malnourishment. Her gums became badly infected, and she frequently hemorrhaged. Chang was released as the revolution reversed course in the mid-70s. When she got out, she learned her daughter Mai Ping had been beaten to death while under arrest. In 1978, officials apologized for what they termed Nian Chang's wrongful arrest. She was granted a visa after relations with the United States improved. She left China in 1980 and now lives in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your husband had been in the Kuomintang government. Most of the officials from that government fled to Taiwan
after the revolution.
Why did you and your husband decide to stay in China?
There were two reasons. One was, of course, we were not hostile to the idea of socialism. When my husband and I were students in England, we attended the London School of Economics. The London School of Economics in the 30s was a very left-wing university, and we learned a lot about socialism. It sounded very idealistic, and we thought it might bring about a more just society. Another reason was we lived abroad for so long. We were 7 years in Australia, where our daughter was born, that we felt that we lost touch with our own country. My husband decided that he was a PhD in international law and international relations. He decided that he could teach in the university and not be a diplomat if we remained in China. But we were too naive. We were what I now call muddle-headed liberals. We were too naive. We didn't realize that because of our personal background, we were really unacceptable to the communist regime.
What was expected of you? You were both wealthy people. When you decided to stay in China after the revolution, were you expected to distribute your wealth or hand over any possessions to the government?
No, the people's government, even to this day, does not want to confiscate private property. In fact, they even allow inheritance. You can pass it on to your sons and daughters. It's not that. It's just that during Mao Zedong's lifetime, he mistrusted people like ourselves who were educated abroad, especially in democratic countries. He thought that we would necessarily be against him. He used to call people like us radishes, red outside, because we say we support the people's government, but white inside.
You were one of the few families, I think, who managed to maintain their pre-revolutionary lifestyle in Shanghai. How did you do it?
That's because with the people's government's permission, we live like that because of the fact that my husband, late husband, was general manager of Shell. The people's government wanted Shell to remain in China because the major American oil companies had all withdrawn after the outbreak of the Korean War. And also we received many foreign visitors, the ambassadors and representatives in Peking, when they came to Shanghai, were all entertained by us.
But did people in your neighborhood or other people regard you with contempt because
you were wealthy
after the revolution?
Because they knew we were allowed to live like that by the government. And we maintained friendly relations with our neighbors. They weren't hostile, not until the Cultural Revolution.
When the Cultural Revolution started, Shell closed down. The Chinese branch of Shell that you worked at closed down. You were expected to do a self-critique. Can you explain what one of those is like?
The Cultural Revolution was initiated by Mao Zedong. In the early stage, he called upon the Red Guards, who were high school students, to destroy the Four Oaths, to bring China a step closer to communism. Socialism is the preliminary stage before communism. He felt that by destroying the Four Oaths, China could be brought into communism much sooner. Mao Zedong had a quotation which all the Red Guards recited. It said, unless we destroy the poisonous weed of old society, the flowers of socialism cannot grow. And what were the poisonous weeds? Were the Four Oaths: old culture, old customs, old habits, and old way of thinking. I was classified as class enemy, so the Red Guards came and ransacked my house.
When they were ransacking your house, they destroyed a lot of your possessions, and you described them destroying some 300-year-old teacups that you
had. Wine cups. And they were stepping on them. It was really terrible because these things, although they were in my possession, they really are the cultural heritage of the Chinese people. So I tried to persuade them not to continue with their destructive efforts, and I tried to speak to them the value of what they were destroying. But they weren't moved by that, and they said these are toys of the feudal emperors and the capitalist class. They are useless for us, the proletariats. And so I said to them, you want to start a world revolution. These are valuable. You can sell them in Hong Kong. So for a large sum of money, that persuaded them. So I saved about three-quarter of my collection.
It was interesting to me that these 300-year-old wine cups were a symbol to both you and to the Red Guard who was trying to destroy them. To you, they symbolized your link with the past.
Yeah.
And to them, they symbolized bourgeois values that had to be destroyed.
Yes, that's right.
And they symbolized the old past that had to be destroyed.
Yes, that actually you can't cut up history. History is a continuous process. Actually, Chinese should be proud of our history and our cultural heritage. Americans even value Chinese history. And just visit American museums. There are many Chinese historic relics displayed in American museums. And yet, Mao Zedong wanted them to be destroyed. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, many of the people, including some of the people who used to work at Shell, where you worked, did these self-critique sessions in which they were supposed to confess to...
Yes, they did self-criticism. Self-criticism was an inherent part of thought reform, what is commonly known as brainwashing. Unless you criticize yourself according to their theory, you cannot accept new ideas. So you have to renounce your past by making self-criticism. then you empty your head of all these old ideas, then you can absorb new ideas. Actually, I think a mature person has already formulated his ideas, his sense of value. It is impossible almost to change. So it can only be changed gradually. You can't just get rid of everything you believed in 1 hour and so on. So most people do it as a formality. It doesn't really mean that they changed. They fall in with the demand of the party in order to avoid trouble.
My guest is Nian Cheng, who has written a memoir of her imprisonment during the Cultural Revolution in China. It's titled Life and Death in Shanghai. Why did you refuse to do self-criticism?
Oh, I didn't refuse to do self-criticism. I could criticize myself for leading a standard of life that was superior to the masses. I was ready to do that. But they accused me of being a spy of foreign powers. That's something I cannot admit because I wasn't a spy. And it's a serious charge in my view because loyalty to one's own country is a basic thing for a qualification for being a citizen. I was a citizen of China. It was my duty to protect my own country and not to betray it. And they accused me of being a spy of the British. That was such an insult. I simply could not admit it because it was not true.
Were you surprised when they came to take you away to prison? Did you expect that to happen?
No, I didn't. Of course, many people in China were taken to prison when they weren't guilty. It's a possibility, but I couldn't say that I thought it was a certainty that I was to be put in prison. But I was determined not to buckle under just because they put me under pressure, including prison. I had to preserve my integrity.
One of the women guards in prison said to you, "You're a smart woman. Why don't you just confess? If you confess, we'll let you out of here. You can resume your life again."
You know, that's just hypocrisy. If I did confess, they would have sentenced me to labor camp. I wouldn't have fared any better. In any case, I wouldn't have considered such a course of action. It's against my principles.
When you were taken away, did you have any time to put your life in order before you left or to say goodbye
to
people?
No. I was taken away from a struggle meeting. A struggle meeting is a mass action. The victim stands either in front or in the middle of a large number of people, and these large number of people were encouraged by the organizers to inflict insults and bodily harm on the victim, primarily to frighten the victim into submission.
You had several servants, and people might think that the servants would denounce you at a time like that. Were you afraid of that?
No, I wasn't. What was there to say? I had a clean record. I was never against the people's government. I had nothing to hide.
Let's talk a little bit about what it was like when you were taken off to prison. I'm going to ask you to describe what your cell looked like.
The cell was not too small, about maybe 8 feet square. Cement floor, cement wall, very dirty, cobwebs dangling from the ceiling, a naked bulb, maybe 15 watts hanging in the center of the room, and a tiny window very high up in the wall with iron bars and all covered with soot and dirt, and a wooden bed, which was no more than a plank with four legs, was where I had to sleep on, and two other similar wooden beds were stacked on top of each other. I used as a sort of table to sit on and to put my wash basin and so on. It was bare, and the cement toilet attached to one corner of the cell. And with the water I washed myself and washed clothes, I poured in there to keep it clean.
You were in solitary confinement for about 6.5 years.
Yes.
What were the most important things for you in keeping your dignity intact during that period?
Well, I fought back. I tried to clear myself. When I had interrogations, I argued with the people who were the interrogators. They pressured me to confess. I tried to live through all the hardships, coped with everyday life. For instance, I tried to clean the cell, and the wall was so dirty and the bed was so narrow that I was afraid my bedclothes would inadvertently touch the wall. So I pasted by crushing the rice grain to make a paste. I pasted toilet paper on the wall to protect my bedclothes. And I made, because the light was never switched off the whole night long, I made an eye shade with the handkerchief that I had. Every Sunday, the prisoners were allowed to borrow a needle, and we were allowed to buy thread with our own money. So the prisoners were allowed on Sundays to do mending and sewing, and I made eye shade to cover my eyes. Things like that. I tried to improve my physical environment. But there was nothing I could do to overcome hunger, cold in winter. No matter how much clothes I put on, I continue to shiver because of being undernourished, with never having enough to eat, always hungry, and very, very hot in summer, and the cell had many, many mosquitoes.
I want to talk with you more about what your imprisonment was like, but we have to take a short break first. My guest is Nian Chang, and we're discussing her life, which is the subject of her new memoir, Life and Death in Shanghai. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Nian Chang. Her memoir, Life and Death in Shanghai, describes her imprisonment during the Cultural Revolution. We were just describing what your cell was like, and you were taken out of that cell for interrogations occasionally.
That's right.
Would you describe what one of these interrogation sessions was like?
Oh, they asked me about the whole history of my life, and always they tried to... They also asked me to write my biography several times. They tried to find discrepancies in my answers so that they could make something of it. You know, you must be lying. Why are you saying this instead of what you said yesterday? Things like that. So you have to be extremely careful and very alert not to fall into their traps. Some of their questions were loaded questions, you know. It was a strain, but when I return to the cell, I usually go through the question and answers over and over again, over and over again. And I would try to remember the expression on the face of the interrogators. Sometimes more than one man firing questions at me, shouting abuse and shouting, confess. Why don't you confess? What do you hope to get out of it? If you don't confess, you will die here. We will never release you, that kind of thing. I try to remember everything and analyze everything so that next time I might cope with it better.
What's amazing was how you used to argue with your interrogators,
yes,
and try to use logic and,
yes,
quotations from,
yes,
Chairman Mao
because,
to make your case.
Yes, because I had plenty of time in the cell, and I had always studied the communist government, and I read many books by Marx and Engels and so on. In fact, I was better informed about Marxism than those young people who were interrogating me, you know?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that they were young, and it was young people, too, also who invaded
yes.
your home
yes.
and destroyed yes. all your art objects. I mean, did they have any respect for you as,
no.
an, as an older
no,
woman?
No, no, that's all Confucianism. They denounced that long ago. One of the Red Guards said anybody over 30 was no good. It was a mad time, a really mad time. Those Red Guards now are older and wiser. They were victims, too.
You talked about how much you'd read Marx and Engels and also Mao. There were quotations from Mao that you, were, I think, were able to use
yes,
for
to refute them.
And to refute
because
them.
Because Mao has said so many things at different occasions. You can always find something to use.
Well, one of the things that you quoted, I think, to yourself was, first, do not fear hardship. Second, do not fear death.
Yes. That's what Mao said to the Liberation Army. But Lin Biao, who was second in command at that time, said Mao's words were universally applicable, so I could use it too.
You wrote that you were surprised that you were able to survive the 1969-1970 winter, that was the worst part for you.
That's right.
It was bitter cold.
Yes.
Your
gums and my health was deteriorating so fast. My gums were bleeding. I could hardly chew the hard vegetables we were given to eat. And I was going through my menopause, and I had frequent hemorrhages. A large amount of blood was lost. It was miserable. And I had bronchitis, coughing all night long and turning to pneumonia, high fever, being in a coma for days. It was just terrible.
It's always hard to figure out how someone does manage to have the emotional and physical stamina to withstand that. And I wonder, you know, sometimes if you have something that you believe in as
yes.
fervently
yes.
as your interrogators believe in what they yes. believe in, then you can hold up. Did you have something to believe in?
Well, I believe in God. I believe in a just and merciful God. I thought God was putting me to a test, and it's up to me to go through it and not question.
When they finally released you, they wrote a statement, which you quote in your book, and if you don't mind, can I ask you to read the statement that they made? That they
yes.
Here, I marked it off. You have reading glasses?
Yes.
I'll wait until you take them out. And my guest is Nian Sheng, and she's written a memoir about her imprisonment during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. It's titled Life and Death in Shanghai. I marked it off there. I thought
yes.
it would be interesting to have you read it.
The above-named person was brought to the number one detention house on September 27, 1966, for the following reasons. One, in October 1957, in a letter to England, she divulged the grain supply situation in Shanghai. Two, she defended the traitor Liu Shaoqi and opposed the Central Committee resolution passed on Liu Shaoqi. These are serious matters that deserve punishment. However, in view of the fact that she is politically backward and ignorant, we decided to give her a chance to realize her mistakes. After 6.5 years of education in the number one detention house, we observed a certain degree of improvement in her way of thinking, an attitude of repentance. We have therefore decided to show her proletarian magnanimity by refraining from pressing charges against her and allowing her to leave the detention house as a free person.
Now, what was your reaction to this statement?
Oh, I was mad. I was livid because, A, I didn't divulge anything. The grain supply to all the people in Shanghai was open, not a secret. There were many Europeans who lived in Shanghai who received the same grain ration. What was there to divulge? Another thing, when they brought me to the detention house, Liu Shaoqi was still the chairman of the Chinese People's Republic. He was denounced only during my imprisonment. How could they have anticipated that I was going to speak well of him and bring me to prison? So these were trumped up charges of fraud completely.
You refused to leave the prison.
Yes, I said to them, I cannot accept your conclusion about my case. I shall remain here until you come to a proper conclusion. The proper conclusion is a declaration that I was completely innocent of any political crimes or mistakes. And then you have to apologize and publish the apology in the newspapers in Peking and in Shanghai, because in these two cities, I have relatives and friends. I shall remain here. And they said, this isn't an old people's home. You can't stay here all your life. I said, I don't have to stay here all my life. If you give me the proper conclusion and apologize, I shall leave tomorrow. They said, if the government tell you to come, you have to come. If the government tell you to go, you have to go. And they dragged me out.
They had to drag you out of prison. Well, eventually the government did apologize to you.
Not until 1978, in November.
You're living in America now. The Cultural Revolution is over. Do you consider the Cultural Revolution an aberration?
Yes.
In the revolution?
Yes, absolutely. It was a catastrophe for the whole of China. But it did one good thing. It precipitated the present reform policy.
So you're in favor of the reform policy now, and you think China's a better
place
now?
Oh, yes. I'm 100% behind the reformist leaders.
What kind of life are you living in Washington now?
Oh, I have a wonderful life. My only regret is my daughter is not here with me. I'm sorry that I didn't come to America when I was younger with her.
Are you still investigating her case, or is that quite clear now?
No, that's already quite clear. I attend an institute for learning in retirement organized by the American University. I take courses of studies painlessly because no exams, no credit, and I enjoy it.
Was it hard for you to re-enter life again after this long period of imprisonment? You weren't used to seeing people. You weren't used to eating food. I mean, weren't used to anything.
No. I always read. I had never lost touch with Western culture, except during the Cultural Revolution. I didn't use English, but I used English up till then. And I ate European food, and I read the Time magazine, and I had books sent into China, and, I was not out of touch with Western culture.
Writing your memoir forced you to relive every detail of your suffering.
It was very painful. It took me more than 3 years. There were times that I had to lay it aside and then pick it up again after a few days.
Has it helped you put it behind you?
Now I feel better. I no longer have such frequent nightmares. I feel more peaceful in my mind, too, because it's all written down and put aside.
We only have a few seconds left, but I wonder if any part of you wants revenge against the people who hurt you.
No. I don't want revenge. But I do wish Deng Xiaoping has the courage to declare to the world that Mao Zedong was entirely wrong.
So you think he was entirely wrong?
Yes.
Okay. I want to thank you very much
for
talking with us. And my guest has been Yan Cheng. She's written a memoir, which is titled Life and Death in Shanghai. It describes her imprisonment during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. Life and Death in Shanghai is published by Grove Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with folk singer Joan Baez, so I hope you can join us. Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we hear from musician Carl Finch, founder of the band Brave Combo. They're out to prove there's no such thing as square music. They play a repertoire from Lawrence Welk to Jimi Hendrix. Also, our rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks back at The Remains, a 60s group that was a hit in their native Boston, but never quite made it nationally. We'll hear what the rest of the country was missing. Book critic John Leonard reviews two new biographies of French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, and we'll have a news update from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. President Reagan said today he will go ahead with a plan to place 11 Kuwaiti oil tankers under U.S. flag protection. The reflagging should be complete by mid-July. Administration officials say the decision is based on the fear that failure to protect Kuwaiti shipping would lead to greater Soviet influence in the region. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger says it is important for the U.S. to maintain its presence in the Persian Gulf.
We will no longer have any position in the Gulf that we can occupy safely, and that, I think, would be an extremely adverse thing for our national interest.
Many members of Congress opposed the reflagging plan. Democratic Senator Alan Cranston was one of several congressional leaders who met with President Reagan to discuss the decision.
There are grave risks involved in this policy, and once we embark upon this approach in the Gulf, it will not be easy to extract American forces from whatever engagements develop there.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee approved a bill today that would prohibit the president from going ahead with the reflagging operation. The Reagan administration also announced a new diplomatic initiative to end the Iran-Iraq war. The U.S. has asked the United Nations Security Council to pass a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the seven-year-old war. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North today turned over seven binders full of documents to congressional committees investigating the Iran-Contra affair. North received a formal grant of limited immunity before surrendering the papers. North answered a series of questions during today's 15-minute closed-door session in preparation for private testimony tomorrow and his appearance next week at televised congressional hearings. South Korean President Chun Doo-hwan will address his nation in a few hours. He's expected to announce his acceptance of major democratic reforms called for by Roh Tae-woo, the head of the governing Democratic Justice Party. The BBC's William Horsley reports on some of the reasons the government has agreed to opposition demands.
A senior official in charge of organizing next year's Seoul Olympic Games has suggested that the national consensus for hosting the Games successfully played a key part in the final resolution of the political crisis. The offers to hold the Games elsewhere, he's quoted as saying, aroused the Korean people to defend and uphold the Seoul Olympics. The government has also acknowledged that the frequent scenes of large crowds of citizens being chased and tear-gassed by police played an important part in the dramatic decision to go down the road to democracy. The police say that more than 350,000 tear gas shells and grenades were used to stop protests in the latest nationwide demonstrations. Today, for the first time since early June, there was no trace of the asphyxiating gas in the streets of central Seoul.
William Horsley in Seoul. A state of emergency was suddenly lifted today in Panama. Emergency rule was imposed 20 days ago after thousands of people staged violent street protests against Panama's military government. Coinciding with today's lifting of the state of emergency, government newspapers urged that Panamanian citizens join a massive anti-American rally. The government today conducted a small underground nuclear explosion in the desert about 75 miles northwest of Las Vegas. The test, yielding less than 20 kilotons, was the ninth announced detonation of a nuclear weapon at the Nevada test site this year. The trial of former Gestapo chief Klaus Barbie is winding up in Lyon, France. The prosecutor today urged the jury to sentence Barbie to life in prison, the maximum legal sentence in France. Barbie is accused of deporting hundreds of French citizens, including a number of children, to Nazi death camps during World War II. The jury is expected to return a verdict on Friday. Stocks on Wall Street closed sharply lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 28 points, finishing at 2,418.85. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Sharon Green.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has dug into his record collection once again and come up with The Remains. The four members of this rock group got together when they were students at Boston University. The Remains were the opening act for some of the most popular 60s groups, but outside of Boston, they seldom made it to the top of the bill.
'65 was a year when it looked like rock and roll had unlimited possibilities. The Beatles had expanded the form on their album Rubber Soul, and the Rolling Stones were right behind them, dabbling with protest music in a song called Satisfaction and writing a ballad for string quartet called As Tears Go By. In America, the time was right for the emergence of a new kind of rock and roll, or several, and it was happening. In New York, Bob Dylan rehearsed his electric band in preparation for the Newport Folk Festival. In L.A., Jim McGuinn was struggling through his first recording session using a bunch of studio musicians instead of his band, the Byrds. And in Boston, the Remains were sitting on pins and needles, waiting for their first album to be released. Why Do I Cry was one of the cuts on that album, a record that should have put the Remains on the map, but it didn't. The Remains were phenomenal. They could write songs with the musical sophistication of the Beatles, and they could play guitars in a way that combined the virtuosity of folk music with the toughness of rock and roll, much like the Byrds were trying to do. They had bratty, Stones-like vocals and, thanks to their recording contract with Epic Records, access to some of the finest studios in the country. So what went wrong?
On how life should be lived and things should be done. But I'm here to say you gotta do just what you want. And when they start of their talk, talk, talking, remember just one thing. The truth is the light.
The truth is the light.
The light is the way.
Light is the way.
The less
Don't Look Back was their only hit, and it was only a hit in Boston. In those days, regional hits were all very well for regional labels, but Epic, a division of CBS, needed something a little more powerful. Convinced perhaps a little too quickly that the band wasn't the Beantown Beatles, Epic soon forgot about them and finally dropped them entirely. Despite opening for the Rolling Stones in 1965 and doing the entire last Beatles tour the next year, the remains never caught on. Songs like Thank You had the sound of the times down pat, but maybe the remains were ahead of their times. They broke up in 1967, just as a host of San Francisco bands who weren't half as good started making headlines. Eventually, their guitarist, Barry Tashian, wound up in Emmylou Harris's band, and the rest of them? Well, who knows? In this business, it's best to take their advice. Don't look back.
Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Carl Finch is on a crusade to turn the uninitiated onto polka music. He's an artist-turned-musician who in 1979 founded the Texas-based New Wave polka band called Brave Combo. Finch grew up in Texarkana listening to rock and roll. He discovered polka records in a dime store bargain bin. That was in the mid-70s. At first he thought the music kind of campy, but he soon got hooked on the beat. He formed Brave Combo, and the group began playing traditional polkas, along with their own versions of pop and rock songs, set to the polka rhythm and other dance beats. Their venues ranged from Polish dance halls to weddings to rock clubs. They've released 4 albums. Their new album, Polkatharsis, is their most traditional to date, but it still shows off their sense of humor. That's Brave Combo's recording of the New Mind Polka. I asked Carl Finch to tell me about his early introduction to polkas.
I was doing these things, these audio installations at different spaces around the state, you know, whenever there would be gallery shows that I was accepted in. And I was exploring just the idea of sound and music, and I liked this sort of generic sound of Muzak, and I also liked the kind of surprise sound of polkas and ethnic music that I could mix in with these kind of Muzak-y things. And then I found myself choosing to put these records on, like on Saturday morning or something, you know, like just around the house. And so finally, that became the music of my choice, you know, and I found myself enjoying the music purely for the music's sake.
When you organized your band and you started playing in different kinds of venues, did you play in a different way for new wave audiences than you did at the kind of festival where people had always liked polkas? I don't know if you played any of the ethnic festivals or polka festivals.
Well, right at first, we played them the only way we knew how, because we were only listening to a couple of different styles. We were listening primarily to European and Scandinavian polkas and Mexican polkas, and that was pretty much all we had ever really, you know, analyzed. So right at first, our sound was pretty much just driving both of those, the Eastern European and the Scandinavian, as well as the Mexican polkas, are all played pretty fast, spryly, you know, with kind of a nice clip to it. And with that being our only influence, we sort of added this rock and roll kind of edge to that, and that was sort of the Brave Combo polka sound.
Are there young people who still dance the polka?
Oh, there are more than ever now. In fact, I think one reason that we've been popular in a lot of the ethnic communities is that we're sort of, I think, bridging a gap in some cases between the older generation and the new, because a lot of the bands are older people that the younger people can't relate to. One of my favorite memories is the first time we played the Jimi Hendrix polka at a festival just to see what would happen, and we had as many older people smiling and dancing and tapping their feet as younger people, and that really struck me as an unusual thing, because it doesn't, the only thing that really sounds like a polka about it is how we're playing the beat.
What's your ethnic background? I'm wondering if there's any, you know, ethnic roots that you're rediscovering by playing this music.
For myself, there's none. I come from just about as normal an American background as you can imagine. Whatever normal is, but, you know, sort of the Leave It to Beaver background. Pretty much just grew up playing rock and roll, you know, and going to church and and then deciding I didn't want to go to church anymore and then going away to college, and that's about it.
You know, one of the things that I really love about your band is you have rescued a lot of songs from the jaws of schlock, and you've taken some songs that I grew up really hating and have made them fresh and interesting, and I'm always really grateful to musicians who do that. For instance, of the Anniversary Waltz on your new record. You have a really lovely duet of it.
Thanks.
And you're featured at the piano, and that's a song I, like many other young children, had to learn how to play on the piano.
Right.
And it seemed like such a tiresome thing. I know it's a Strauss waltz, but why did you do it?
Well, you know, you've actually hit on really what Brave Combo is about, much more than polka. Polka's become just sort of a one side to us, but really we look for unhip, ignored, rejected forms of music and songs that, for some reason, got sort of a bad reputation, not so much because of the music, but because of how it was presented. The music is great.
Another song that you rescue that I really wouldn't have believed had any beauty is The Happy Wanderer. That's a song that has the Valderaz in it. And boy, did I hate that song when it was a big hit on the radio back in the 1950s.
Right.
What prompted you to revive that one? The only version I've ever heard was the one that was a hit, and I can't even remember who
did
it.
Yeah, I remember that. I think, you know, it's funny, like, we didn't even play that. Even being in a polka band, we didn't play that for years. We didn't play it until we actually started to work on Polka Tharsis, which was you know, less than a year ago, and then we were just sort of messing with it one day, and then it just sort of, there it was, and we started kind of figuring out that what really was neat about it, at least what we discovered was neat, is messing with the dynamics of the song, where I would sing the melody at the beginning and try to, like, at the very first part where I'm going, I love to go a-wandering, try to bring the band down right there so that you're immediately attached to the melody and you follow the melody line through at the beginning.
I love to go wandering along the mountain track, and when I go
What kind of songs have you tried to do that don't work, that not even you can make interesting?
The theme from Romeo and Juliet several times, and it can only exist as it exists. We did one time do it as sort of a jazz swing thing, you know, da 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 da, but then it just kind of started sounding like Tonight Show stuff, you know. And we're thinking about maybe trying to work out an arrangement to Candyman, that Sammy Davis Jr. song, but I don't think there's any way for it to be much more than it is, you know. It might work and it might not. At the very least, something like that can at least be something for shock effect.
You're doing both now. You're doing things with irony and doing things straight. It depends on the material.
Well, yeah, and, you know, one thing that's real important to us is that people don't ever think they have us completely figured out, because really what we're kind of about, we're trying to take the idea that hip has to be there before you can like something out of it, so that people can think for themselves. And by throwing in all these other things, kind of taking something that people can relate to, I think a lot of times that kind of puts people at ease and makes them realize that we have a sense of humor, and we're not just looking at music as this thing that's always to be revered with 100% reverence and that we can't have any fun with. Even though I think we're sometimes kind of treading on thin ice, we want to keep surprising people. You know, we want to, we're into this certainly for the music, but we're also into this for the life of the band, and so people can come to a Brave Combo show and maybe not completely know what they're going to experience.
Carl, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Carl Finch's band is called Brave Combo. Their new album, Polka Tharsis, is on the Rounder label. Finch spoke to us from member station KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, today we take a look at the Supreme Court contenders. The list of possible replacements for retiring Justice Lewis Powell is quite short, and it's headed up by Robert Bork, a conservative federal appeals court judge. Today, the White House is sounding out Senate leaders about the chances for a quick confirmation of Judge Bork and several other choices. Also, Terry, we have high art tonight on the show. The Bolshoi Ballet is performing in New York, and slightly lower art, Hamlet the musical comedy, is now being staged by Atlanta's Southern Theater Conspiracy. In it, Polonius is a Jewish patriarch, and Hamlet's mother Gertrude is something of a sex kitten.
Okay, well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two major biographies of the French philosopher and activist Jean-Paul Sartre are now available in bookstores. One is Sartre: A Life by Annie Cohn-Solal. It was first published in France in 1985, 5 years after Sartre's death. It's now available in an English translation. The other book is Sartre: A Biography by Ronald Heyman. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
We may think we know all about Jean-Paul Sartre. Philosophizing novelist, pamphleteering playwright, celebrity intellectual, pope of existentialism, tireless ambassador of the French left to the Third World, opposed equally to the United States in Vietnam and France in Algeria, suspicious equally of the determinisms of Marx and Freud, the man who refused the Nobel Prize for Literature. What we might not have known without reading the 1,200 pages of these two new biographies is that Sartre was also a one-eyed, chain-smoking, piano-playing, pill-head, and booze-hound and womanizer. When he wrote his novels and his splendid autobiography, The Words, he was careful and sober. When he wrote philosophy and polemics, he was stoned, usually on a compound of aspirin and amphetamines. He doped himself up to kill God. He wrote anywhere, in hotels and cafes, on the barricades and in jail, and was seldom alone. There was usually a woman in the room with him, sometimes his mother, more often, for 50 years, Simone de Beauvoir. He didn't get along with men his own age. He lost more manuscript than most writers publish. He could have been another Proust or another Spinoza. He chose political commitment instead, to, quote, think against myself. Even to think against his own vocation as a writer, he stopped writing novels altogether. Literature itself, he felt, was middle-class denial and bad faith. On the street, the word was crude. Language and history was a blunt instrument. None of this bothers one of his biographers, Annie Cohen Solal, who's along for the ride with a wicked grin. It mightily vexes the other, Ronald Heyman, who likes neat bureau drawers. Cohen Solal, an Algerian-born critic of French literature and culture, seems to love her man even when he behaves badly. Heyman, who has already been disappointed in previous biographies of Kafka, Nietzsche, and Brecht, pounces on Sartre with a net and would staple his wings to a wall. From Heyman, we get who's who in the novels and a reliable rundown of important terms in phenomenology and disapproval of the sex habits. He is also, justifiably, fierce on the subject of Sartre's fellow traveling with the communists in the early 1950s. Sartre's apology for the Russian gulag, in particular, was contemptible. But from Heyman we also get, regrettably, a reductive psychologizing that makes me wish I'd never heard of Oedipus or incest. It's as if Heyman had to cut a giant down to size and fit him in his own tiny pockets with the small change and the Freudian spiders. By contrast, Cohen Solal, like a shaman, assumes the skin of French culture and spins, speaking tongues. Ideas show up in her pages like rainbows. Her style owes a lot to Sartre's own enthusiasms for jazz and movies. It cuts and jumps and dreams and bops, from close-up to fade-out. After the century had used him up, after old age had put out his remaining eye, after he had given away his money to friends and causes, even then, among the student anarchists and Maoists, he was thinking against and revising himself, a hero of culture who hated his culture. If I were you, I'd spend my money on Cohen Solal.
Our book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's what's coming up on our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with sculptor Jody Pinto. Her latest piece is a pedestrian bridge shaped like a finger. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review an album of Bach compositions for harpsichord. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will shed some new light on the problem of illiteracy. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Karen Murdrick and Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.